Joining us now is Matt Ball, founder of Metaverse ETF. You have been writing and talking about the metaverse.
So Matthew, tell us, can we start with what the metaverse is not?
I'm often asked these questions. Why do you believe the metaverse is so significant? And if you can't fully predict the future, that's because of the recursion of technology and the ways in which these new technologies lead to different behaviors and different experiences.
Touch the evolution of the metaverse, we touch the prediction of the metaverse, we touch data protection, we touch AI, programmatically generated content.
We underestimated how much sophistication was needed to manipulate this. The person's real, the situation looks real, the image looks real, the context is fictitious. But does that go haywire on social? Absolutely.
I have a tough time imagining that anything will fully substitute for.
Hello and welcome to Field of View, the podcast where we expand your horizon of the metaverse. My name is Daniel Colaiani from AIXR.
And my name is Nick Rosa from Accenture. And today we have a very, very exciting guest. We have the person that literally started the movement of deep analysis of the metaverse market. We have the person that wrote some of the most important essays about the matter and recently published a book called The Metaverse and How It Will Revolutionize Everything. Ladies and gentlemen, today we have the real master of the metaverse, Mr. Matthew Ball. Hi, Matthew. How are you doing?
I'm great and really excited to be here today.
Thank you so much for joining. So as we usually do, we always ask to our guests to start with a little bit of their origin story. We would like to understand a bit more about your passions, your background, and what took you to cover the metaverse as you do right now.
Sure, that's a fun place to start. My work experience has been pretty diversified. In the 2000s, I was a wild firefighter, initial attack. It was a full-time gig. I started my own business issuing professional boating craft licenses on behalf of the Canadian Coast Guard before shifting to private equity. I focused primarily on the virtualization of defense systems. That's kind of your early tip towards this outcome. And then I shifted to Accenture, which of course you know well. I spent 5 years in the TMT strategy practice, really up and down telecoms, publishing, video game and interactive, Hollywood, and some of the hardware and OEM providers, including even in automotive. And then I shifted towards a company called the Churning Group. We built, bought, developed, and scaled many of the first digital-first communities. Companies like Crunchyroll and Barstool Sports, Twitter, Medium, Pandora, SoundCloud, where we were majority shareholders at some points. Then I joined Amazon, where I was the first global head of strategy for Amazon Studios. And then I started my own firm in 2018, focused on gaming and a little known topic then, at least as related to the mainstream, the metaverse. So in that period, I've developed skill sets in terms of deep simulation technologies for infrastructure and understanding of the global media environment, the technologies that it requires, servicing customers, and then building out one of the world's largest media businesses. And that was a nice convergent point for this super convergent technology. But my interest in it, like I would assume both of you, spans decades. I've always been obsessed with video games and virtual worlds, with storytelling and the ways in which technology was changing both of those. And it was my experiences in 2018, really playing a lot of Fortnite, spending a lot of time on the Roblox platform, which led me to believe that this 30-year-old term, century-old concept, and long-attempted idea was starting to unfold around us.
And now you are an author. You just published a wonderful book called The Metaverse, and How It Will Revolutionize Everything. You're touring the world. How's life as an author?
It's been fun. It's been exhausting. I think it's been extraordinary beyond just the specific field of application, in the sense that, you know, at Amazon, I helped oversee billions of dollars in programming investment. I was primarily in content strategy. So what are we going to greenlight? And then afterwards would return to evaluate it. And just going through the process of, as you know, end-to-end content creation, marketing, the key decisions on promotion, reading the reviews, owning the outcome in a very different sense has not just been fun and thrilling. The publicity's fun, the feedback's fun, but it's so illuminating to everything else as you're in and around this space.
Is this your first book, right?
Yes. Wow. First and at least foreseeably only.
Well, never say never.
I find that interesting, right? Because I think while this is like your first like published book, you've been writing kind of on these topics for a very long time and publishing some really useful insights on quite a vast array of different digital and technological aspects of things as well, right?
Yeah, I started writing in 2013. I was at Accenture still at the time, at least as a public blogger. It might have been 2012. And, you know, the interesting thing about it is you're quite right that it's pretty broad in its coverage. That's a reflection of my professional expertise, but my interests. But I also think it's inextricably linked with this field. In my book, I go into great length to talk about the many different intersecting pieces of technology. The metaverse can't just be thought of as XR hardware. It can't just be thought of as hardware. You have to think of it as computing processors and network chips and standards and and the rest of it. And so understanding this from multiple different angles and professional interests and professional history and personal expertise, spending a decade strumming through various themes as an author was pretty essential. I wrote the book over a 6-month period. It was the culmination of 4 prior years writing on that theme, but a decade of writing on other themes in and around it. Without that, it wouldn't have been possible, or certainly not as good.
I mean, there's so many different areas, right, that you probably could have written a book about, given your vast array of experience, and especially with your experience within the film and television space and the production space. What made you really land on metaverse being, you know, this topic that you felt needed to be written about?
That's a fun question. I mean, look, when I started writing this book, it was 2 months before Mark Zuckerberg ever said his intention to transform into a metaverse company. And that was itself 4 months before he renamed the company. And I think you can generally see that as a pivotal moment for it as a mass idea. But my first essay on the theme was 2018. I had another one in January of 2020. It was extraordinarily popular. It had a few million reads by the end of that year. It was still doing, you know, 10,000-15,000 a day. And so that plus my overall conviction led me to believe that it was a worthwhile personal undertaking, professional undertaking. I believe that it's of such critical importance that making more publicly available the things that I had learned in the space, which was not available to most people, which reflected large corporate conversations, R&D I'd participated in, my startup portfolio, that seemed like it was important and worthwhile. And I had never written a book, but I loved writing. And then, of course, it became le mot du jour or d'année last year. And so that was not predicted and has certainly been helpful while also elevating the stakes of what was published.
And what you just said about the deep stack of the metaverse is super important from my point of view, because a lot of people believe that the metaverse is just that surface that you can see, like Roblox or Fortnite. And in fact, many people refer to them as metaverses, which is from my point of view, multiverses, which is from my point of view, something that gives me like the shivers on my back, on my spine, because it's like saying the internet, because the metaverse is like an infrastructure, right? So, but there are so many layers. So there's just one metaverse and the metaverse is an infrastructure. But the toolbox that leaders can utilize in order to apply this new concept to their business and their enterprise is so vast. How can, from your point of view, leaders inspire their teams to start envisioning metaverse opportunities with their area of work? It can be like networking, can be, I don't know, processors, can be GPU. What is the spark that they can use and they need to use with their teams?
Great question. So, look, I'm often asked these questions. Why do you believe the metaverse is so significant? And I don't love the subtitle of my book, How It Will Revolutionize Everything. It's a little bit bombastic for my personality, but I do believe it. And I think that there are really three ways in which you can unpack it. And I try to be a first principles thinker. And so sure. I don't want to talk about a specific instantiation, but I'll explain at least why I find it exciting. You know, first and foremost, the internet is one of the most important technological innovations in human history, like truly over the thousands of years. And we are talking about a successor to it. Fundamental changes in that technology set should excite all of us, because history tells us society changes, business changes, governments change, the products that we use, the business models that are deployed, the way in which leaders and philosophies and corporations are, they're all affected by the internet. The second thing is to recognize, or as part of that, we're not just talking about a revolution in idea. It's that, as you know, building the metaverse requires deep alterations and enhancements to everything upon which the internet is built, TCP/IP, networking infrastructure, hardware itself. And so if you already believe the internet is remarkable, which it is, it's 20% of the global economy, and we have to upgrade most of it in our architecture and design and prioritization, that's a huge opportunity, especially for a business leader. The second way to think about this is to recognize what makes that change. And I try to articulate that, as an example, the real revolution in mobile was not that you suddenly had a computer in your pocket, that you had anytime access to the internet as opposed to occasional access to it. Those two points are essential to what I'm going to say, but they weren't the revolution. The revolution was that when you did that, you structurally shifted who accessed computing and networking resources, when, where, why, and how. Billions of new people used that those two resources. They solved problems that they never before imagined. And that is what led to the widespread change. That's why all of these fields in which we believe the internet or a personal computer sitting on your desk would not reach, it did reach. That's exciting to me. And then the third is to talk about some of the instantiations. We're seeing XR devices used in surgery. We're seeing it now deployed into the military. We're seeing it being used to design buildings with simulation down to the atom, the sound wave, the light beam, to improve energy efficiency. We're seeing holography deployed to ease the ails of video conferencing, to produce greater emotional connectivity. I really do believe that when you take those theories at the most high abstraction, the internet, then talk about how we're changing its architecture, then talk about what that means for who uses these things, and then just look at some of the primitive deployments where we're actually not even talking about the metaverse. We're talking about a network. We're talking about a specific application, right? XR software is just running an app.
Yep.
Two people. They're so remarkable that I find it incredibly inspiring.
So one of the comments I get a lot when I'm speaking with people in this space, so I come from probably a stronger background with virtual reality and kind of that area of space. One of the comments I get from when I speak to people, especially in our community at this point in time, is that they consider themselves a VR company, but now going forward, they have to call themselves a metaverse company. And there's always different things on different semantics and definitions and different things that people go on, but do you think it's right for, I guess, someone who's maybe been in this space from, you know, 2017 when we really start to see that full resurgence, maybe 2014 with Oculus, and would consider themselves a VR company, and then now going into this space mainly due to all of the publishing and media that's going out, they would refer to themselves as a metaverse company. Do we think that's necessarily right or wrong, or what's your take on that?
The semantics don't really interest me. I mean, I certainly agree with the perspective that calling something a metaverse versus some platform in the metaverse is taxonomically wrong. The former is. The latter would be correct. And yet, as we know, everyone uses the term metaverse as singular.
Yeah.
We may find out, my guess would be, that we lose that battle. People just call Roblox a metaverse. Ford will have its metaverse. And over the long term, the whole term will go away. We'll just talk about the internet. Maybe we say the 3D internet to differentiate ourselves generationally from the internet of the 90s through to today. And that kind of extends to how I find people saying we're a metaverse company a bit of a nuisance, but I've kind of tried to move beyond caring. It reminds me of when companies would just get a .com in the 90s, and then all of a sudden they're an internet company. It's like, okay, you have a web page. That doesn't make you a digital company. That's a far more fundamental cultural, financial, and philosophical decision. But at the end of the day, while it's easy to be a little bit dispirited by how many people are riding on this theme and how random it often seems, it's partly a reflection of the fact that the metaverse affects everyone if it is indeed a successor to the internet. And that means, yes, it sounds a little bit strange when Chevron says we're going to grow in the metaverse or Panera. And yet that has to be true for it to be the next generation of the internet. And so it is in some regards both a bug and a feature that everyone says they're now part of it.
I have a question that is related to the blockchain and the centralized aspect of the metaverse. And I think that that's one of the topics that I would like to cover in the next few minutes with you. A lot of people believe that the blockchain technology is a central part of the creation of the metaverse, being able to tokenize assets, being able to port assets from one platform to the other, being able to securely transact and affirm the ownership of those assets using this kind of secure technology. But there is a problem from my point of view, and I wanted to take have your take on this, the fact that there are loads of companies that because of legacy systems, because of legislation, because of policy, because the systems have been built or created in a certain way, it is impossible to migrate them all together towards blockchain technology, they will always remain centralized metaverse companies. What's your take? Is the metaverse destined to be blockchain-based or centralized, and decentralized metaverse companies will go together for a very long time?
So really fun. And the reality is we have to recognize that even on the most decentralized foundation, centralization is a byproduct of growth and investment. The web itself is heavily decentralized, and yet our experience on the web is heavily centralized. We all aggregated towards Hotmail and then to Gmail, to Facebook, and to the decline of ICQ and the absolute devastation of even large programs like MSN. Even when we take a look at crypto platforms, OpenSea has nearly 90% share of marketplace transactions of NFTs. They don't own your account, they don't have payment information stored, and they don't actually fulfill or manage the inventory. And yet, despite that and the fact that they charge more than many other marketplaces, and of course, you can do a peer-to-peer transaction for free, I mean, less than network fees for gas, people use OpenSea. And now OpenSea is centralizing with verification and curation. Insurance seems likely. They blacklist and they whitelist. And so we should understand that these are natural. They're natural because a centralizing effect is brand, is trust, is habit, is IP. That has nothing to do with technical centralization or decentralization. And so my underlying perspective is that no matter how strong Web3 tech is and how widely adopted and how widely deployed, we'll see centralizing effects. But that's separate from whether or not we see centralization versus decentralization shift in its pole. If we were decentralized in 1993 and we're hyper-centralized now, it seems likely that we're going to shift back towards decentralization partly. And the question is how much? And that doesn't necessarily require full decentralization. But certainly, to the extent in which one wants to say, will we see them side by side? Yes. Why? Because I cannot run a device right now, not really, that is decentralized in operations. A multiplayer server cannot be decentralized right now. And there are good reasons to believe for the laws of physics, you can never have a decentralized server running a multi-user simulation. Not unless you want it to have 2 or 3 frames per second at best. And so I do think that the world is going to have fully decentralized applications, partially decentralized ones that are mostly centralized, and then entirely centralized ones. And then you'll see trade-offs between the two. A little bit like saying, we all have bank accounts. It doesn't mean that we don't also have a petty cash drawer at home.
Clear. Thank you for your answer. I have another question for you that is more related to the moonshot aspect of the metaverse. Because right now, we are all operating and talking about this mythical creature that is the metaverse that is not yet here fully. I mean, we
according
can
to
see
some people.
We can
depends who you ask, right?
Well, we can see that is about to be a reality. There are a lot of money behind, and there are a lot of companies that are changing their names and they're changing their business in order to make it happen. And obviously, the ball started rolling, and it's going to be very difficult to stop this snowball from going down the mountain. My question for you is that we saw this declaration of the metaverse that is going to revolutionize everything and is amazing, and a lot of companies believe in it, and we have this vision. How much do you think that this vision will become really a reality? This decentralized world where you can bring your asset from one platform to the other? Because it seems to me that, I mean, our vision of what mobile landscape was going to be in the 80s and then materializing the 2000 and 2010s was quite different. So do you think that the metaverse in the end is going to be substantially different from how we imagine it?
Is it going to be substantially different from how we imagine it? Yeah, for sure. Okay. Of course. it's funny, like, you were asking what's it like to be a global author? And I've done so many interviews in so many different countries. I've done 3 different languages today. And everyone wants to know this answer, right? What is life like in 2032? Or how will the metaverse change what I do, how I feel, and whom I love or see? Or just tell me what happens when I wake up in the morning and what I do when I get home.
Yeah.
And the inability to answer that question is, I think, inevitable. Yeah. And yet, folks do expect you to proffer an answer as though it's answerable. Mm-hmm. And therefore, when you don't or you eschew it, most are disappointed, and that's totally valid. Look, I'm a little bit disappointed that Tim Sweeney or Jensen Huang can't just be like, this is the answer. I know it. I've already built it and people do it. That would be really fun.
Yeah.
And some respond to that with, okay, so it's vaporware. And the answer is we can't know. And here's why we can't know. First and foremost, technology is recursive.
Yep.
You create technology, and then that reveals or leads to new behavior, which is then responded to with this network of other innovations where someone says, that's interesting. I didn't know Nick would do that. And so I'm going to build a product for Nick. And good examples would be social. No one thought billions of people wanted to share photos of their daily life several times per day. We now produce an estimated 800 times more photos in a day than the total photos produced a year in 1999. You would have reasonably said, yeah, we'll create more photos if they're digital and you don't have finite capacity. But no one would have ever estimated that quantum. No one would have ever said the role of deepfakes in now election engineering. And so time tells us we can't fully predict it, but I also think it's the logical answer of what I mentioned earlier, which is if each era is about transforming who accesses computing and networking resources, when, where, why, and how, the consequences of that are so double, triple, quadruple, click, compounding that we're just swinging in the dark, right? What happens when everyone can access effectively unlimited cloud-based runtime? No idea. What happens when everyone can create 3D simulation as easily as they can type in WhatsApp? No clue. I don't think we can know.
So Matthew, it's quite well documented that you're a gamer, right?
Yes.
Yeah, and I envy you for that, because I love to play video games, and yet I absolutely love the way that you're able to balance sometimes playing video games and taking meetings at the same time with them. That's something that I need to employ in my life.
I don't think that it plays games while taking meeting at the same time, though.
I definitely do that, but sometimes we put the meetings inside.
Oh yeah, of course.
But sometimes I get away with it.
But that's what I mean, like, you know, being able to jump into and play a Fortnite game with someone and actually have that meeting at the same time. My question to you is like, I've read a lot, like, okay, you play, you know, quite a few different 2D, I guess, like what I'd refer to as like flat screen kind of games. Obviously they're 3D, but do you play any like VR games at all?
I do, not as often, partly because little of my social network is, you know, richly in them.
Okay, because this was going to be my question as well, and I wanted to jump on a little bit about the investment and VC side of things, but it was kind of just, you know, one of the arguments that I've always had at the moment when it comes to, you know, jumping into some of these virtual worlds and playing on like a VR headset as an example, is sometimes I get home and I just want to sit down on the sofa and just relax. Whereas a lot of VR experiences do require you to be quite active and kind of active participation, because it's obviously you're interacting in a 3D environment. So just wondering to understand, I guess, how you, as a gamer and also as someone who vividly understands, you know, the direction of the metaverse, how you think that may develop in the near future, to bridge that gap between how people traditionally play video games at the moment and may then integrate that into more aspects of what we're describing as the metaverse.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, one of the challenges as we consider, you know, really interactive mediums overall, is they're not actually that flexible. And look, if we take a look at television has 5.5 hours per day in the United States, 300 million people watching 5.5 hours of television. Seniors watch 7.5 hours. TV is an incredible bundle. It's a bundle of genres, yes, but of function, education, news, cultural participation, relaxation. It's a bundle of different engagement styles. Lean in, your phone's off, the lights are off, you're watching Game of Thrones and you love it. And then it is, you know, more lean back. That's just where you're watching the average thing. And then there's lean out, right? It's in the background. You're ironing, you're doing the dishes, you're doing homework. And then, of course, it's a bundle of many, many different forms of competition and so forth. And so this extensibility of function, of purpose, of intensity and of access facilitates its cultural dominance. When you take a look at gaming and interactivity, you know, on the one hand, it's still harder. When you're talking about XR, you're talking about putting on devices that isolate you from the rest of the world. And the functions are far, far more limited. Now, we're seeing growth there. News is going there. Education is going there. But it's still primarily lean in, intense, exclusionary behavior with high skill requirements for leisure. And until we see some diversity on each of those axes, I think it's still going to be constrained.
I wanted to ask you something a little bit different. We can dive a little bit more into the philosophical aspects of the metaverse. One of the things that a lot of people sometimes don't immediately see in this revolution that the metaverse is going to bring is the fact that the concept itself of what we call reality in 20 years from now is going to be completely different. Because a lot of the digital content that is now on those digital platforms that we call metaverse platforms right now, once we're going to have this dream of the interoperability, will bleed down into the real world. And the metaverse is going to be this connecting tissue between the digital reality and the real world. And this promise of, you know, socially acceptable glasses that will, you know, augment our world and our vision with digital content, will paint the world with data, will create an effect of making us think that the reality augmented, and there's a wonderful book called Reality Plus about it, it's going to be something that we cannot prescind from. Is that exactly like right now, we do not get out of our house without our mobile phone because our life is more or less meaningful. We are not connected with people and so on. Do you think that this is going to have an impact on the way that we live our actual life? Do you think that the real life, the life that we live in the real world, will be less meaningful because of it? Because we're going to have all these other amazing lives and amazing possibilities of augment our world that we'll not want to be able to disconnect from this digital world in some way.
I don't. I mean, I generally... One of the full theses for the metaverse is that 3D and immersion and presence and tactility matter deeply to the human experience. It's more natural.
Yep.
For that same reason, I have a tough time imagining that anything will fully substitute for or even ever really compete with that real thing. Sitting across from a good friend at a bar, slapping their back is just always going to mean something. Sitting in a football stadium with 60,000 cheering fans, I think there will always be something about that that feels richer and deeper. Doesn't matter the frame rate, the resolution, the haptics, the spatial audio in a VR device. That's just always going to be incredible. And yet that doesn't mean we won't still close the gap in those other experiences without undermining that other aspect. I'm more interested in the ways in which we can augment for what is lost when that isn't available. I spend a lot of time these days talking about holography because holography is a good example of substitute or complement, not substitute, or substitute of the tech inadequacy, not the real thing. Would still be great if we could record this in person. We could be sitting, making direct eye contact on a couch, laughing. We'd pick up cues differently. We'd be more enriched. Zoom is a bad substitute for that. But holography enriches that in an important way. And again, I don't think it undermines the real, but where the real is not possible, these technologies are certainly bringing more of that to us.
What's interesting, based on like Nick's question there, and I hope I'm getting it right, Nick, is I guess there's this sense that when you have a mobile phone, it's almost a social oddity if you do not have that phone with you when you go out, right? So let's assume for one moment that the same may happen or will happen with augmented reality as an example, where we take these digital worlds with us as we go out to meet friends or to things like that. And in all honesty, there is a very real possibility that if you are not connected in with your augmented devices into this kind of metaverse environment, that you're disconnected from pretty much everything that you need to be able to do things. And just using that as an example is a more in an extreme way. But I guess like just to build on Nick's one there is this world where we have to be connected on a even deeper level into the metaverse really exists. And an example could be, I guess, where, this is an idea that I absolutely hate, but I can actually see it becoming a very, very real reality is when someone is wearing an augmented filter for their face or something like that. And, you know, we already have that on Instagram and those devices where people will post photos exclusively with a filter, not an AR filter, yeah. But having that in a real time situation is very existent. And it's not as easy to just say, just switch it off because you need to be connected into this environment because everyone else is. Just hot take on that. But I just wanted just to ask your opinion on that, I guess.
Well, I think that's probably right in the same way that we just know that for certain cohorts of people, for example, a video gaming console is an important part of their ability to socialize with a specific group of friends. Now, one can ask what's wagging the dog, or is the dog wagging the tail, in the sense of, does the criticality of that device and that experience reflect the organic interests of that community, or are we getting them so that we can then talk to one another, if you get my point? But it's all circular. Society changes. When I grew up, socializing was coming home and going on an IRC chat or a text-based message board. And that's no longer a particularly popular modern form of communication. And those that do require different devices and different experiences. At the same time, I tend to find that the arguments that that is alienating or exclusionary tends to be more fleeting than we assume. You know, if you go back to 2012, there was a lot of alarmism as to whether or not the use of iPads in schools would widen the income inequality gap and the educational access. Well, right now, the cheapest iPad is one half the cost of the very first iPhone, and that's before inflation, right? The iPhone in 2007 would be more than a grand now, and you can get an introductory iPad for $280. And was there a period of time in which the average person couldn't get an iPad? Of course, it was unaffordable. And so that is to say, society evolves. You will probably need these devices to interact with some of your friends, depending on whom your friends are. And for a brief point of time, we'll probably find that these devices are too expensive for everyone to participate in. There's also an argument that because XR is so hard, that will last longer than just the iPad hold, but it'll compress.
I now would like to dive a little bit more into the data and profilation of the users on the metaverse. And I have another question after this that is related to the use of deep learning model in the metaverse. There are some concerns by many people. And one of the most vocal proponents is Louis Rosenberg, that you may know, that the metaverse needs to be regulated as quickly as possible, because there's the real danger that the amount of data that will be generated on this platform will be able to create a fingerprint of our behaviors and our needs so perfect that will be almost impossible for us not to be manipulated by companies that are using that amount of data to create deep learning models of sales, digital salespeople, to sell us things and to make us believe in things and to change our mind on our political views and so on. What's your take on this? And what do you think that needs to be regulated on the metaverse? What's urgent to be regulated on the metaverse from your point of view?
I'm certainly a big believer in regulation and that we need to strongly or more strongly influence its development than certainly governments did during the mobile era. I don't subscribe to the Heideggerian perspective that most technology is, or that technology is not neutral. Too many double negatives there. But, you know, if you take a look at classical Heideggerian technology theory, you would say that it isn't neutral because we don't understand or appreciate the implicit hold technology has over us. And that's what leads to both active and passive and sometimes accidental manipulation or behavioral shaping. And we certainly saw that with the social era. Right? It took us a long time, right? What happened 15 years ago? We talked about the filter bubble, but the filter bubble was actually about excluded information. Then we suddenly came around to realize the real pernicious bit was about the reinforcement of radicalized perspective. It was the inverse perspective on that echo chamber. And so, look, I believe that that's important. The interesting aspect of this is I believe the metaverse is inevitable because all of the technologies are being solved. Every year, computing processors become more efficient. Doesn't matter if Moore's law is over. Broadband improves in latency and in coverage. But as a result, I'm far more interested not in whether or not the metaverse is technologically realized, but whether or not the metaverse as we build it is collectively prosperous and healthy. How do we achieve that? I think that there are probably three different perspectives.
Number one, I'm curious.
Is to take a look at how regulators in particular are unbundling different elements of the ecosystem, right? Apple grew over 20 years because of its remarkable integration of operating system and hardware, Mac and Mac OS X, iPhone and iOS. But as the digital realm has grown and matured, we realize that it's actually a bundle of many more things, of hardware and operating system and first-party software and software distribution and identity and payments and of tech standards. And I think that governments, most notably in the EU, are right to drive unbundling of those so that you have full technological expression and competition at each layer. A second will be on data portability. And as much as the EU is right to say that we should be standardizing charging ports and that that's good for competition, look, if USB-C matters, then data import export metadata coherence matters. And then the third is probably this question around firmer data rights to the user. Data literacy is only going to go so far. We've learned that. We also know that platforms such as Apple are able to manipulate the portrayal of those warnings. And so I wouldn't be surprised if we started to see overt legislation that just says, you cannot have this data, or you can have this data, but only anonymized. Or if you have this data, it has to be custodied within national boundaries. That sort of nuanced consideration is going to be key, as with overt prohibitions on the use of data for certain activities, such as, you know, are you, if an XR device knows that you have kids, which it will know, is it allowed to ever report that information?
But do we think that this kind of regulation might actually backfire in a way where we're talking about obviously really big organizations and companies here, which have the infrastructure, the money, the resource to meet the requirements of regulation, but actually could this stifle startups and new players into the market because they simply don't have the resource to meet the regulatory standards?
Will it backfire? Of course it will backfire. The question is, of course, will it, you know, let me put it this way. Will it have side effects and unintended consequences? Will some be perverse? Absolutely. At the same time, I do think that the right cohesive strategy can avoid some of what you just mentioned. So for example, if you unbundle all of the layers of competition while obligating compatibility of data, right? This is point number one and then point number two. You are in theory preventing from isolating or suffocating competition at a given part of the stack while making it easier for someone to access the information that you do store for that competitive product. And if you take a look at what Microsoft has unveiled, this came from Brad Smith, their vice chairman, he spoke about in great detail that their long-term objective is to make it so that all first-party services and third-party services can access the same platform data. Now, that's not panacea. It's still going to be harder. Doesn't mean that a small startup is going to use it as effectively, but that's important. And then the other element is to recognize that the prohibition on certain data points does diffuse some of that as well. Because if you are just saying, to use a non-specific example, Meta, you can't have that data, then at least you're chipping away one point of advantage versus this new startup. Generally, reducing the data that can be housed or collected or used and standardizing how third parties can use it and depriving companies of rights of retention should reduce lock-in, not worsen it.
That's a great answer. I have another question that is related partially to what I asked before and is related to programmatically generated content using artificial intelligence. We've all seen in the last few months images of DALL-E, which is this open AI system that is able to generate images using text input. LinkedIn is full of those images. People went crazy. And it's incredible the kind of art that can be generated and photography that can be generated by those systems right now. And obviously, it's not science fiction to think that in the future, this content can be three-dimensional and potentially be used in order to create programmatically worlds on demand for metaverse platforms and for the users. My question for you is the future of content creation in the metaverse driven by AI system? And if so, can this be eventually tied to the profilation of the user needs in order to create a sort of a nirvana for the users where the user will never want to leave? Again, a sort of a metrics kind of scenario where everything is so perfect and everything is so amazing that the computer will always know what you need based on your dopamine need and dopamine hits.
So history suggests that we're only ever, you know, ambitious in that sort of fear, that the full predicted dopamine feedback loop of everything that you might ever want.
Yeah.
You know, it's a bit like the drawings of the 60s saying we'd have colonized the Earth, the moon by now. At the same point, I think as much as we overestimated the pace of technological progress, we underestimated how much sophistication was needed to manipulate us all the same, right? Text in an algorithm, mis and disinformation has proven pretty robust despite having relatively little behind it other than just a social graph, an interest graph. I'll tell you something distressing that I saw the other day, which is, you know, there are a few different systems that are being used, like DALL-E, and DALL-E does not allow you to make images of living persons, and they do not allow certain themes, right? The Holocaust, 9/11. But there are others that are fully open source, which I'll not name here, that can be used instantly. You have 30 seconds to produce an image of remarkable fidelity in 2D. And what happened 5 days ago on 9/11 was a number of individuals who were creating fake images of real firefighters taking selfies joyfully on Ground Zero the day of, arguing that this was an inside job. The person's real, the situation looks real, the image looks real, the context is fictitious. But does that go haywire on social? Absolutely. And so that's actually relatively primitive experientially. Technologically, it's fairly sophisticated. And it's not 3D yet. And it's also not moving. That is terrifying, and it should be terrifying.
Yeah. And this connects very well to what we were talking about before, about the need of regulation of this kind of technologies, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it this is where we talk about the backfire, right? What's the backfire about standardization? Well, we don't yet know what the best standards and conventions and file formats and metadata structures are for the metaverse. We can mandate them and then realize they were wrong. And now companies will never be able to afford porting over, will have sub-optimized systems. You know, like I joke about the fact that the GIF file format is dreadful and it remains the standard. And we can't have such crappy standards in the metaverse. And yet we're all moving to MP4 and that's great. And so there are consequences of this. You stifle innovation, you will destroy some companies, you will prevent some companies from emerging. If you start to regulate how AI and procedural image generation is being used, there will be adverse consequences. I personally don't have a problem saying, you know, the side effects of forcing people to get licenses for the database that they read for their AI generative art programs is a good thing. Saying that you can't use real persons is probably a good thing. Limiting your right for usage, probably a good thing. Like, those barriers seem intuitive to me. In much the same way, it's not hard to get a driver's license, but you do need one. And there are consequences for using one irresponsibly.
So, tapping into the experience that you've been building kind of over these many years, and obviously insight into Metaverse, one of the things that I know that you align on, which really it goes hand in hand with a thought process that I've had, and I always have to bang on about with people, which is about when we're talking about bringing things into the fold of Metaverse, we need to be not just, I guess, creating gimmicks, or not just creating what we can replicate within the real world directly one-to-one towards this technology. Right? And I know that an analogy you've given before was about how, for example, online dating sites, you know, you spend a very long time filling out information on there and to try and find your matches, versus the mobile ones like Tinder as an example, where you just spend 3 seconds to swipe. And that's a differentiation between the technology stacks there. So I'm a startup, or I'm a founder in this space, and I'm coming to pitch you an idea or a company that centers around Metaverse. What do I have to say to you to make you say I'm in, like, straight away?
Sure. So there's a few different ways to take this. Look, I think what you're relating to, which is this online dating example, really brings back to point something that was discussed earlier that I know Nick believes, which is if you can't fully predict the future, that's because of the recursion of technology and the ways in which these new technologies lead to different behaviors and different experiences, which we can't currently envision. And the other example that I use is that if you take a look at what was progressive thinking about publishing in the late 90s, it was that you have a printer at home that prints out the newspaper every morning. And if you were radical, you'd say, yeah, but it's personalized. And what does personalized mean there? Well, if you don't read the sports section, you don't get the sports section. They say paper and ink. You don't like business, you don't get those sections. That was radical. And yet the future, of course, was a version of the New York Times that had no fixed edition. Yes, there's a daily New York Times, but most people don't experience it that way. The articles are indefinitely updated. And actually, what was the future of news? The unbundled newspaper in a newsfeed algorithmically recommended. And so the first thing that I look for from entrepreneurs is where they're playing with more theses on the area of dimension. Not there's no longer distribution, we're printing at home. Not we're skipping the sections they don't want. It's about saying distribution is no longer the problem. Content is no longer fixed in time. How does that change the product of news? Well, you can now date from anywhere on your mobile device. Well, if you're standing in line bored, why wouldn't you date? Well, you can't stand in line dating and fill out a 300-question survey. It's not the appropriate way, but you can swipe a bunch of times. And so I look for the founders who are playing with more dimensions in a reductive way, assuming the world is going to be more different than it is the same or just plainly reproduced. But my favorite type of entrepreneur is really those who have spent 15 years trying to solve these problems within a large company, not because they're jaded, but that can be good too, but because they basically spent 15 years building up the interpersonal network for hiring and basically spending millions of dollars on corporate R&D to figure out what does and doesn't work. And that company and their job history is effectively on the cap table for free. And therefore they say, I still want to solve this problem. I instinctively need to solve this problem. I know who to hire to do it. And I know the first three things you don't try to do.
No, that makes a lot of sense. I think that, there's a lot of founders and startup kind of people out there that tend to jump into this space or try to think that, okay, just because they have a brilliant kind of metaverse idea or something like that, that it's instantly going to get picked up. What do you also think about, I mean, the one thing I always hear investors always say is demonstration of traction, which can be particularly hard in this space when you're relying on other companies and other hardware and things like that, and it's still quite early days. So what's your view on that?
Sorry, on the hardware front or about
early traction? No, just like on the traction side of things.
Yeah, I mean, look, one of the fun things about being an investor in the space is you need evidence of product market fit, and yet you also assume that the entire world's going to get blown open. And you have to discern those two things, which can sometimes be delayed fit, with what a cap can be. Let me give you an example, because I just spoke in buzzwords, right? Like, Roblox released in 2006. No one cared about it for 12 years. No one really heard about it until 2020. The curve of that company's engagement is linear, but it's not steep for a decade. And you could just as easily say this thing is topping out as you can say it's just maturing slowly. And the answer was a mixture of technological improvements of the product, but also technological improvements of the devices, and also about generational change of new young people, Gen Z and Gen Alpha in particular. And so you can just as easily see non-product market fit, stalled product market fit, clear deferred momentum. And that's a thesis game. That's what makes this hard. That's where you see asymmetric bets, or more importantly, what I call like thesis arbitrage. It's just, do you believe in the inevitability of a specific future more than everyone else? And therefore, will you accept a valuation, take a bet, wait longer than others? And in the case of Roblox, I would argue that half of what it was their patience, and half of it was Apple coming out with the iPad. And that is to some extent what we're talking about with XR. At the same time, there's the reverse case. These are companies, and I would argue some of the major metaverse-style dating platforms are an example of this, which is they've stalled out because they were not as big as they imagined. The reimagination of a dating category, let's just have avatars and play mobile games, was not the right expression. It was your New York Times but printed at home. What if Tinder, but in 3D? Not deeply thought out enough. But I could be wrong. It could just be on that horizontal part of the Roblox curve.
Matt, thank you so much for being with us. It's been an absolute pleasure and an honor being having you on our podcast. I just wanted to remind to all of our listeners that there's your book that is out. It's called The Metaverse and How It Will Revolutionize Everything. Sorry, I'll say it again. The Metaverse and How It Will Revolutionize Everything. Matthew, thank you again for finding some time in your very busy schedule to talk
to us.
Thank
you.
I do like to date the modern era of VR to when I was putting duct tape and hot glue on Palmer Luckey's prototype Rift for E3 in 2012.
Did you know you can catch this full episode of Field of View and more by subscribing on YouTube, Spotify, Apple Music, or wherever you get your podcasts? To not miss another immersive technology moment, subscribe today.